What's the best piece of reporting you read or heard or saw this year? A story that challenged your thinking or made you see the world a little differently?
If you were flying in to Mumbai, you fly into the international airport and then you get out of the airport and you make a left. In front of you, you would see a very sleek smoke glass Hyatt and then an ornate Sheraton Grand Murata that's made of pink Jaipur stone. And before you get to them, there's this long wall festooned with advertisements for ceramic floor tiles. And it said, beautiful forever, beautiful forever, beautiful forever on the wall. And there was a break in the wall. And if you turn down through that and you go down a rocky road and you make a right, you open up into this whole world that's hidden behind the wall, which is the world of the people of Vanuatu.
Catherine Boo spent 3 years reporting on the people of Vanuatu. 3,000 squatters who live crammed into 300-some huts on the edge of a lake of sewage. Her book, Behind the Beautiful Forever, has won the National Book Award. Vanuatu has to be one of the most squalid places on Earth. But as Boo told Steve Paulson, that is not the point.
I think that a lot of the writing that gets done about poverty or poor communities focuses on the physical aspects, and particularly in India, on the squalor. And of course, there's in my book, there's squalor, there's the sewage lake.
Well, you tell stories about people to put food on the table, trapping frogs and rats and rummaging through the sewage to find stuff to eat.
Right, right. And you know, they have this idea that the frogs at the Naupata slum near the Intercontinental Hotel actually taste better than the ones in the sewage lake. But what I'm really interested in is not writing about passive people with no agency trapped in a miserable place. I'm interested in who these people are and how they are striving to find a niche in the global economy. Every morning, thousands of waste pickers fanned out across the airport area in search of vendable excess, a few pounds of the 8,000 tons of garbage that Mumbai was extruding every day. These scavengers darted after crumpled cigarette packs tossed from cars with tinted windows. They dredged sewers and raided dumpsters for empty bottles of water and beer. Each evening, they returned down the slum road with gunny sacks of garbage on their backs. Abdul would be waiting at his rusty scale.
Well, tell me about Abdul, one of the central figures in your story. How did he end up selling trash for a living?
It was the work his father could find. He first collected trash like everybody else around the airport, and then he became a buyer and seller of this trash, a middleman. So he had this eldest son, this diffident, awkward eldest son, and he also had 8 other children. So the only way to support the family would be if this child take up the family business.
And then so there's this whole sort of army of people out there trying to gather trash, competing with each other to try to get the best stuff.
And one of the things is that competition has just become increasingly brutal. I talk about a kid named Sunil, who is 12 or 13 when I first met him. He'd essentially been raising himself since his mother died of tuberculosis. And he's undersized. His great dream is to eat enough to grow, to start growing. And so he's working as hard as he possibly can to collect enough trash to be able to feed himself enough to jumpstart his system. But one of the things that happens because he's undersized is, I mean, he'll go to a dumpster and then other people will flash knives or throw stones to keep him away from the immense wealth that people see in rich people's garbage. Or he will spend day and night collecting. And somebody will be waiting who's bigger than him, and then will take his stuff.
So it's brutal.
Get the money for it. It's absolutely brutal. But to me, that's not the end of the story. That's the beginning of the story, because a kid like Sunil is not just going to accept that it's impossible. He's going to use his intelligence to try to find another way.
And we should talk about this. I mean, the central drama of your story is there's an argument that pops up between these two families who live right next to each other, Abdul's family and Fatima, this woman who's known as One Leg. Can you explain what happened?
Yeah, well, let me just tell you about Fatima. Fatima was born with one of her legs ended at the knee. She shares a wall with Abdul's family. On her side of the wall is poverty, true poverty. On their side of the wall, because of Abdul's business, life is improving. There is now a television set, and Abdul's mother decides she wants a slightly better hut And Abdul thinks no, because people are going to be jealous. But she says, no, we've earned this. I want my family to live in a more dignified setting. And the construction of beginning to fix the house ends up getting rubble in Fatima's rice. And through a whole series of events, Fatima decides to use the only weapon she can think of, which is her own body, to destroy Abdul and his family's hopes. And she sets herself on fire. And from her hospital bed, she accuses Abdul, his father, and his sister of committing this crime. She says that they set her on fire.
Well, and the tragedy here is, well, all kinds of tragedies, but the specific one is Abdul and his family were totally blameless. They had nothing to do with this. Everyone knew Fatima had set herself on fire, and yet Abdul and his father and his sister all ended up in jail.
Right, and one of the reasons that they ended up in jail was that the police also knew that they had been making a little money on garbage. And so the police saw this as an opportunity to extract some of that money.
So Abdul and his family, were supposed to bribe the officials. They were supposed to bribe the police, for instance, to get off, but they wouldn't do that.
They were asked to bribe the police, the people who took the witness statements. They were supposed to bribe Fatima's family. They were supposed to bribe the slumlord. So many hands came out to try to take some of this money that Abdul had earned and that they had been saving for a small plot of land outside the city where they felt that people wouldn't call them garbage and might treat them with respect.
And they ended up, I mean, in jail. They got beaten, too. I mean, this was horrible.
Yeah, and one of the difficulties when I do my work is that at the end and all through, you're just constantly fact-checking to make sure that you've got it right. And one of the most difficult parts of that is that in these times, I repeatedly had to ask people like Abdul and his mother to relive some of the worst nights of their life, and it was extremely painful. But they felt that if other people had a sense in depth of the experiences of people like themselves, that maybe there was a possibility for change.
What's happened to Abdul's family?
I don't want to tell you. I want you to care and to know and to find out. But I was with Abdul and his mother and father and the children a few weeks ago, giving them copies of the book, advanced copies of the book. And everybody in the family was excited except for Abdul. And Abdul was like, yeah, whatever. I got work to do. And off he went.
He's still in the trash business.
He's glad that the book is out there, but it's that's not the biggest issue in his life right now. The biggest issue is making sure that his family gets another shot at middle-class security.
Yeah. Now, there's also a story behind the story here, and that's how you, as a privileged white woman from America, came to tell the story, because you would seem to be totally out of place in Adiwadi, and yet somehow you managed to come to know a certain segment of Indian society that even many Indians who've read your book say they didn't even know existed.
In the beginning, when I came, it was, I was the found entertainment. I was just a freak show. And it was impossible to do the kind of reporting that I practice, which is not sticking a microphone in front of somebody's face immediately. It's spending time with them. It's going where they go, doing what they do, whether it's stealing from recycling bins at the airport or teaching kindergarten. And at first, I couldn't find a translator who wanted to work in this very patient style in conditions that were quite terrible. There was malaria, there was dengue fever, and there was tuberculosis. So it was a lot to ask another person. So I would just start coming back day after day on my own and at night. And I think that they understood that I wasn't afraid to be in their community on my own. And I think that made an impression. People said it did.
Did you have an ethics on how you approached this, on what you felt was the right way to tell this story? I mean, given the fact that you are writing about people who are very poor and, often their stories are not told well.
I have an ethic in my work that my experience, like, my going into the slum, my falling into the sewage lake and all these other things are not part of the main story. So I keep myself out of it and try to make as clear as possible the enormous intellectual capabilities that are at work among the people who are trying to find a way into the middle class.
This is a point worth reiterating. I mean, there's no first-person narration in the story. I mean, the word I never even appears until the author's note at the very end of the book. I mean, you've deliberately kept yourself out of the story, which is, frankly, what a lot of American journalists would not do.
Well, I feel that the subjects that I care most about, whether it's in America or in India, are things that most people don't want to read. And so my job is to understand that I have a limited amount of space. I want every sentence to count. I want every sentence to bring you closer, not to me as a writer, but to the people that you might not otherwise meet. I want you to understand the way that a kid like Sunil, this young scavenger who's raising himself, I want you to understand his immense appreciation for natural beauty and how even he would rather some days go hungry than to pick some beautiful flowers he's found amid the trash in behind a wall at the airport and sell those flowers in traffic by the Hyatt. He wants to believe in the beauty of the world, and it's that important to him. And the more that I'm talking about myself, the less time I have to tell the readers about a kid like that.
Catherine Boo won the National Book Award for Behind the Beautiful Forevers.